Well, hello everybody, and welcome to our BIPs webinar series. My name is Lloyd Llewellyn Jones. I'm Professor of Ancient History at Cardiff University, and I'm really delighted to be hosting this particular webinar, which we've titled Open Sesame, Ancient Persia and the Greek Imagination. And I'm delighted to welcome to this seminar Dr. James Fraser, who is a curator in the Near East Department in the British Museum. And more importantly, even for this particular event, he is the chief curator and really the kind of imagination and the mindset behind the British Museum blockbuster exhibition, Luxury and Power, Persia to Greece, which is attracting huge crowds in London at the moment. And I'm glad to say really great reviews as well, both amongst the press and amongst the public who are visiting. So it's a wonderful opportunity to showcase ancient Iran within the British Museum, drawing not only on the great collection of the British Museum itself, but also on many international lenders, including treasures from Thrace that are rarely modern day Bulgaria, which are rarely let out of the country. I've been working with Jamie myself on aspects of the exhibition, and together we've decided to do this as a kind of joint enterprise to talk a little bit about the rationale of the exhibition and kind of some of our favorite things in it through this filter of Open Sesame, Orientalism and the Greek imagination, as it were. Jamie, I'll hand over to you.
Lovely. Thank you very much, Lloyd. Lloyd is doing himself a disservice there, because I think if there was ever a co-curator on an exhibition, I think Lloyd has taken that title. This is as very much an expression of his imagination as it is mine or my colleagues such as St. John Simpson here at the British Museum. And I'm very, very grateful for the input that Lloyd has had in steering the course of this exhibition. Notwithstanding two costumes that we've recreated, Persian costumes, that Lloyd really recreated in part with some funding from BIPs, which you can see in the exhibition, and I'm sure Lloyd will talk about very soon. This exhibition does something, I think, at least I hope, a little different to what sort of mainstream traditional exhibitions do at the British Museum, and do very well, I think. And that is to take one particular region or culture or even personality and explore them in depth. So, you know, at the moment we've got an exhibition on China, we've had one on Peru, Thomas Becket, that sort of thing. This exhibition is slightly different because it's taking a concept, and this is the concept of a very slippery concept of luxury, what constitutes luxury and its relationship to political powers. And it stretches it across the worlds of Southeastern Europe, particularly Greece and Thrace and Macedon, and across the Middle East and Central Asia, the Persianate world of the Achaemenid Empire. And it's doing that in the latter half of the first millennium BC. And built into that exploration, I guess, is an obvious political historical asymmetry. Because of course, and I'm speaking to a very educated audience here, not telling you anything you don't know, but we look upon the Persian world predominantly through Greek eyes, the Greek historians who have written about the Greek-Persian wars, the great clash between these two civilizations. And within that, we look upon how luxury operates as a mechanism, not from the Persian perspective, but from the Greek perspectives, seeking to explain Greek victories over the largest empire that the world had seen. And as you know, as Herodotus describes the capture of the royal command tents, he's building with a true narrator's flair to a kind of denouement, a kind of moment of astonishment, of looking at luxuries in all their splendor. If the Persians campaign in such luxurious style, no wonder they lost. They'd become corrupted and weakened and effeminized by the corrosive and cancerous echoes, resonances of luxuries. And when you go into the exhibition, this is the first case that you'll see. These heads are actually facing each other. It's sort of a curatorial dramatic indulgence, if you like. But the one made in stone looks quite Persian. It's got a very Persian style beard, snail curl ringlets in the hair. It doesn't take too much imagination to see the Persian reliefs from Persepolis of Xerxes or Darius or whatever in this kind of form. The opposing statue made in bronze looks very Greek. It's an Apollo sort of figure done in an early severe classical style, much more serene expression, clean shaven, of course, the knot of Heracles knotted across the forehead. And yet this is the thing about these two statues. They weren't found hundreds or thousands of kilometers apart on the east and the western fringes of these two different competing cultures. They were found 40 kilometers apart on the island of Cyprus. It would have been possible, they were made within a couple of decades of each other, standing in sanctuaries at the same time. It would have been possible if you had a particularly souped up donkey, I think, to have visited both statues from which these heads come in the course of the same day. The island of Cyprus, on which they were found, of course, although it's part of the Persian Achaemenid Empire, is inhabited by different Persian-speaking, Greek speakers, Phoenician-speaking, local Cypriot-speaking groups, all reaching for different styles for different purposes. And when you look at these two statues, although they seem so black and white in terms of being poles apart, actually the boundaries between them start to blur. The stone Persian-looking one is wearing a Greek wreath. And from the clothes that the statue would probably have been wearing, for which we have other examples in the British Museum, he was almost certainly dressed in Greek-style clothes. And the metal bronze statue, although it looks like an Apollo figure, was actually found next to the sanctuary at Tamassos, which was a sanctuary to Resheph, an Eastern god. So a Greek-style god in Eastern guise. And so I guess the raison d'etre in driving this exhibition is not so much we've got this historical conflict between the Persian world and the Greek world, in which attitudes to luxuries are very different and very polarized, that actually when we look at the objects that they leave behind, there's a lot of crossover and a lot of blurring of these different boundaries. And so suddenly you get a lot more nuance about what it means to be part of that broader and highly connected Greek-Persian world. The exhibition is kind of set up in three sections. We talk briefly in the first section about what luxury is doing in Achaemenid Iran. We're exploring how luxury is being used as a highly effective and highly sophisticated tool of imperial statecraft. We then move into classical period Athens, where we see Eastern style luxury reflected through a glass darkly, if you like, into this early democratic society that's rejecting Eastern style luxury as being decadent and ostentatious, and yet hitting it around a very Athenian style anvil to make Eastern style luxury acceptable within this very different democratic society. And then we bring both worlds together under the world of Alexander, particularly the Eastern world of Alexander and the successor kingdoms, where of course in this new international Hellenistic style, we have fusions of Eastern Persian, local and Greek, classical Greek styles, all fusing into one new Hellenistic aesthetic language, if you like. And I'll explore just those three sections really through one example, and that is drinking, and particularly right on drinking vessels. What you're looking at here are three such vessels that we've got on display in the exhibition. The one with the griffin head is in the permanent collections of the British Museum. The one in the middle is a silver rhyton with the head of a gazelle that's on loan from the Louvre. And the slightly chunkier looking one is, I'm really pleased to have this one on display because it's never been to the UK before. It's one from the Erebuni Museum from Yerevan in Armenia. Rhytons look like drinking horns. Of course, they're not. Rhyton is a word that comes from Greek rios, which means to flow. And if you can look really carefully at these images, you might see on the griffin one, the British Museum one on the far left, the griffin has a pendant hanging down across its chest. And there's a recess into which a semi-precious stone or some glass would have been set. You can see that reasonably easily. If you then go down the torso in between the outstretched foreparts of the of that griffin, you might see a stubby, short little spout. This is the spout through which the wine would flow. So imagining me as the Persian king, and that will take some imagination. This is an era of reclining dining. So the king is reclining on a couch. He has the right one held up in one hand, his thumb stopped over the spout and balanced dexterously on the fingertips of his other hand is a gold or silver bowl. A servant would fill enough wine in the riton to fill the bowl, although that riton can take up to 1.5 bottles worth of red wine, though don't ask me how I know. Then he would unstop the spout to release the stream of wine into the drinking bowl and he would drink. This is an act of theatre and an act of performance and an act of showmanship as much as anything else. And I think you have to imagine the king in his large tent, perhaps traveling between the various capitals. There's been a large banquet of the various nobility, the aristocracies, the satraps, the governors gathered together, the king in the rarefied area where only the select few can visit and drink with him. And that gold and silver riton, the fine wine, the fine food, is bestowing prestige and authority upon the king. But it also works the other way around, because of course the king, by using these sorts of vessels in this sort of way, is bestowing prestige and authority upon the objects as well. And that's particularly important because of course the king is gifting these sorts of objects out as he moves around the empire. And that system of largesse, of gift giving, is not only bringing the ruling elite who are representing the king's authority into the fold, buying hearts and minds, if you like. It's doing more than that, because after the king has long left, the ruling elite in his stead are using these same objects to perpetuate their own authority again to those who they're ruling over, thereby kind of emulating and perpetuating the king's authority at all levels throughout the fringes of the empire. And I think you can see that particularly well in that slightly squat Erebuni riton, the one from Armenia, because it's probably made from a local Armenian craftsman at this time. And although it looks quite Persian in the way it's reaching and the way it functions, it's quite different in the sort of the shape and the style. It's chunkier. It's actually got three spouts at the top, and it shows local sort of echoes of Urarturian kind of techniques as much as it does Achaemenid. What I find fascinating, and I'm going out on a bit of a limb here, but what I find fascinating is that the spout there is a Persian rider. It's a Persian rider with a beard, a Persian hat, the Persian riding trousers, the Persian short sword hanging over his tunic, over the saddle cloth. And I find that quite extraordinary, because in Persian ritons, you don't find Persians making Persians on Persian ritons. To me, this is perhaps like during the British Raj, a Maharaja learning to play cricket so that he can be more English than the English. Is this a local aristocrat or a local ruler on the fringes of the Persian world, up in the Caucasus, being more Persian than the Persians, reaching for something to show authority that owes its genesis to sort of the Persian center? Oh, and here's our two of our wonderful collection managers when we were measuring up these objects before display, kind of showing that relationship between the riton and the bowl. What you're looking at now is a slab from a relief called the Nereid Monument. The Nereid Monument was constructed as a mausoleum for one of the local Anatolian dynasts, a guy called Urbanas, around about 393 AD BC. So we're talking sort of southwest Anatolia at Xanthos at this time. The facade of his tomb we've got recreated at the British Museum. We're right on the cusp here between sort of the Ionian Greek world and of course the Persian world, and this local Anatolian king is playing on both tropes. His mausoleum looks like a Greek temple, although it's surmounted on a podium as you would a Persian tomb. But what I find fascinating is that when it comes to his insignias of power, there is nothing Greek at all about what he's doing. He's got his Persian beard, he's got his riton up in one hand and the bowl in the other. The insignias of power are those insignias of Persian luxury, just as you would the king. I love the little dog underneath the couch on this. It just reminds me of my dog back home. And although I think you can see the success of this imperial court style moving horizontally through the various courts of the Persian world, I think its success you also see because it's moving vertically down different strata of society. The objects you've got on the left here, or at least my left, are the elite gold and silver objects as you would find in the court of a ruling dynasty. The ones on the right are in clay and in bronze, and these were found in the tombs of Persian soldiers stationed at a place called Devehuyuk near Carchemish on the border between Syria and Turkey. And in fact, they were dug by Lawrence of Arabia, T. Lawrence, during the Carchemish season. And at one point, he writes back to his father, it was archaeological derring do of the highest order, because he chases tomb robbers from these tombs and has to clear out some of the material overnight before the robbers could return. I think the physical similarities between these are obvious. What the Persian soldier, the drinking kit with which he's buried, the wine strainer, the riton, reference very clearly the elite sort of stuff being used by the Persian aristocracy. But whereas one is the Gucci handbag, if you like, that you buy from a high-class Bond Street boutique, the other is the Gucci handbag that you would buy outside Tottenham Court Road station. But it's the same thing, and it's showing, I think, the success of that system. When we get to Greece, and by Greece in here, I'm particularly talking about Athens, because of course, Greek is a series of city-states, all independent with different forms of government. Things are a little different. Greece, of course, resists and then ultimately repels the Persian invasions of southeastern Europe, which, although perhaps a minor skirmish on the western fringes of the Persian Empire, is a seminal moment for the Greek national, or the Athenian national psyche. As an Australian, I kind of compare it in my mind to Gallipoli. Modern Australia, the psyche of modern Australia would not be the same without the battles of Gallipoli in World War I. And it's kind of the same thing, all pervasive. But of course, drinking in ancient Athens was a very different affair. We're talking a symposium where adult male citizens would gather together in a particular symposium hall or the private room of an individual. Dining couches would be aligned along the inside walls of the room so that no one was preeminent over the other. This is a democracy where social inequality is quite deliberately trying to be suppressed, even if it is present. And a symposium is about equal drinking. An MC would be elected by those present for the event, not necessarily the owner of the hall or the owner of the house in which they met. Now, indulge me, I've got a description of a symposium which bears no relevance to this at all, the Persian imagination, but is just a lot of fun. Three bowls of wine only do I mix for the sensible. One is dedicated to health, the second to love and pleasure, the third to sleep. When this is drunk up, wise guests go home. The fourth bowl is ours no longer, but belongs to outrage. The fifth to arguments, the sixth to drunken revel, the seventh to black eyes, the eighth is the bailiffs, the ninth belongs to bitter anger, and the tenth to madness that makes people throw things. It's a wonderful description, and I rival anyone to find a better description for the British Museum staff Christmas party. What I love about the drinking cups that you associate with the symposium are these animal-headed ones that I've got on display here. These are exotica. They're novelty items. They never become mainstream. But those Persian rhytons are there resonating in the Athenian society. Some of them are captured as booty off the battlefield. They're kept inside repositories such as in the Parthenon. And we know this because they're inscribed on kind of inventory lists, ancient kind of Excel spreadsheets, if you like. And of course, Herodotus tells us about how the booty was captured and divided amongst the Greek hoplites, Greek soldiers who would never have access to this sort of luxury before. So I think these sort of Persian objects of ultimate, unimaginable luxury are buzzing and humming, changing the Greek perception and imagination about what luxury could mean in this somewhat resource-poor limestone peninsula. But the concept of a right on that sort of prestigious, ostentatious way of drinking is anathema to the equality of a symposium. And I think Greek potters respond to it in some really innovative, clever, subversive ways. Although potters do make rhytons initially, they whack on a handle, they whack on a flat base, and it just doesn't work. That early experiment kind of flickers and dies fairly early on. But what you get are these sorts of vessels, these extraordinary animal-headed drinking cups. They're not pouring vessels, they're drinking cup vessels, but the animal head owing its genesis, if you like, to the animal heads of the Persian rhyton. But here, they're not to bestow prestige, they're the butt of jokes in which everyone in attendance is part of that in-joke crowd. Imagine drinking the wine from that donkey-headed cup in the center, and you literally become an ass in front of all your mates. The more wine you drink out of the boar-headed cup, the more animalistic you become, snarling, losing your humanity, becoming more outside yourself, that sort of Greek ecstasis. My favorite, though, is this falcon or eagle-headed drinking cup. You can see the pointed beak of the tip, the sharply defined eye underneath that very high eyebrow ridge. Now, this is an object all about transformation. You can't put this down. Once that's full of wine, you're stuck with it until you've finished it. But when you do, the only way to put it down is to turn it upside down onto its rim. And then the whole thing changes. It changes from being the head of a bird to the complete bird itself. The beak becomes the hooded head of a bird of prey, the eyebrow becoming the high sort of shoulder of the and ridge of the bird's wing. It's a playful, innovative, very Greek response to something that is ultimately Persian. And of course, you can see this sort of thing in the way that the Greeks are responding to Persian parasols as well. Parasols being one of the macho, masculine Chuck Norris symbols of Persian masculine royal authority. Again, also referenced on the Nereid monument by King Urbanus in Xanthos in Western Turkey. But in ancient Greece, in ancient Athens, if you are a man to walk through the agora with a parasol or with a servant with you behind you with the parasol, is a very destabilizing thing to do. You're referencing political authority, political leverage, which is anathema to that society. It's a very destabilizing, very dangerous thing to do that ultimately could lead to charges of Medization, Persianization, resulting in your ostracism from the city. But in the world of the feminine, that's a different matter. And you see parasols, particularly in the latter half of the 5th century BC, after the Persian peace, becoming quite chic objects of cultural cachet with Athenian women. And of course, here they've been neutered of any of their political danger, because in this early democracy, of course, power is held by male citizens, not female. So they've been stripped of any authority they had in this kind of act of subversion, taking something that is so particularly masculine and royal and subverting it into something particularly Athenian and feminine. The third section deals with the sort of compilation of styles, the hybridization of styles under Alexander the Great and the successor Hellenistic kingdoms. And Lloyd mentioned at the very beginning a loan that we've got from ancient Thrace, modern Bulgaria. This is the famous Panegyristi treasure. And if you do anything in the exhibition, bolt to the end section just to look at this. It is quite extraordinary. And the main question we've been getting from members of the public is it real? How have you polished the gold? And this can't actually be real gold. And of course, the answer is yes, it is real. And no, we haven't polished it. This is what gold treasure looks like. It's just luxury on steroids. And I think if you're going to be arrogant enough as a museum to put the word luxury in an exhibition title, you're kind of implicit that you're going to go big. And I think this has gone big. It was discovered in 1949 by three brothers, the Dacoff brothers, who were digging clay in an industrial clay pit for a local brick factory, the town of Panagarishti. They thought they discovered some musical instruments by some Romana travelers. And when this photograph was published in a local newspaper, an archaeologist at the local museum in the city called Plovdiv went, hang on a minute, this is perhaps one of the most significant archaeological discoveries made since the Second World War in Europe. And I think that actually still holds, certainly one of the most spectacular archaeological discoveries to have come out of Europe since the Second World War. What I'm so pleased about this, to have this on loan from the National History Museum in Sofia, is that it does everything I need it to do in the title of this exhibition. And this title exhibition, Luxury and Power, Persia to Greece, it's doing a lot of heavy lifting in that Persia to Greece thing. So this treasure was made about 300 BC, give or take, so a couple of decades after the death of Alexander in 323. And what you're seeing are, apart from that libation dish, eight objects that are all rhytons. They're all wine-pouring objects, even those ones that look like Greek drinking-headed cups, which, of course, is a very Persian way of drinking. And some of them, particularly the rhyton amphora, particularly the goat-headed rhyton, look very, very Persian. And even though ancient Thrace, ancient Bulgaria, has not been part of the Persian world, or at least the Persian Empire, for 150 years, you can still see these resonances, hear this leitmotif resonating in the way that it's been made. But there's also some very obvious Greek references there as well. The three human-headed drinking cup rhytons are all feminine. One has got the griffin helmet of Athena. The other two have sort of stars on the veils, which are referencing Amazonian warriors. And the others have figural scenes punched in relief along their necks or their bodies, all showing scenes out of Greek mythology. Paris judging the beauty contest between the three goddesses and all this sort of stuff. So it blends those two things very neatly together. But the luxury and power concepts is doing extremely well as well. And that's really centered on that sort of key piece, which is the spouted amphora, which is in the middle of the display. You can't quite see it in this photograph, but on the other side of that amphora, what you're seeing is a series of naked Greek warriors with their swords drawn, all attacking the city gates of a city. And it's probably the attack of seven against Thebes. And if you know your Greek mythology, Thebes was ruled by King Oedipus. And Oedipus had said to his two sons, he made them make a sacred oath that upon his death, they would rule the city on his behalf. Of course, he dies, they don't, tragedy ensues. And this is a scene all about the violation of a sacred oath. Now imagine a Thracian king holding one of those centaur-shaped handles with another party with whom he's entering into a sacred agreement, another Thracian king with whom he's marrying his daughter, or they've reached a peace settlement or a financial transaction. So you have two parties holding each of the handles of this vessel. And if you can see the bulges on the bottom, both of those are the spouts. So out of the same vessel, you have the wine flowing in two streams into two drinking bowls, symbolically drinking from the same vessel. And of course, this is a period in which poisoning is a very real tool in the political toolkit of self-advancement. So eliminating that issue of poisoning as well. And so it sort of beautifully wraps up luxury, power, Persia and Greece. But ultimately, what I love about this is that scratched onto the libation vessel and scratched onto that drinking vessel are their weights, because, of course, these are operating as much as bullion as anything else. But their weights are given in two currencies. They're given in both the Persian direct currency and the Athenian drachma. And dare I say, it's like the US dollar and the Chinese yuan today. This is the twilight of the ascendancy of the Persian Daric, and this is the dawn of the ascendancy of the Athenian drachma in the sort of the Balkan Peninsula. And whoever's made this is hedging their bets. And I love that about this. Sorry, Lloyd, I went a bit longer than 20 minutes, but over to you.
That's quite all right, Jamie. What you said was superb. And I shall be quoting luxury on steroids for some time to come yet, I think. I've chosen just one object that I want to look at, one object in the exhibition, an object which I've I've long liked and long admired, actually, because for me, it is a kind of open sesame to a Greek feeling of Orientalism and how it filters the ancient Persians through a Greek understanding. So it's a lekythos, which is a little perfume flask, not very big at all. It was certainly made in Athens, and it dates to around about 410 to 400, maybe even a little later, 380, 390 possibly. It's a beautiful piece. It's very well painted, and it's a very, very lively composition. Here it is in its full dimensions, but we've, for the catalogue for the exhibition, Clara Potter very kindly did a line drawing so we can have a kind of spread of the events that are going on there. And what I want to do basically is to break down what's going on in this vase, because here we have, of course, the Athenian imagination working overtime in picturing the Persians. What we seem to have here to begin with, of course, is a great king, a Persian great king, sitting on the back of a camel and a kind of howdah or a palanquin of some kind, looking very Persian in his strange striped trousers and his long-sleeved garment, and surrounded by members of his court. And you can see there are musicians, there are fan bearers, there are torch bearers, and there are also individuals dancing as well. So it's a scene certainly of some kind of festivity. It's important to say that at the date in which this vase was created, so let's say in the opening decades of the 4th century BCE, the Persian Wars are 100 years gone. And the way in which the Persians had entered into the Greek imagination, of course, was initially around about 520, 500 BCE, where scenes of warfare or combat between Persians and Greeks were common. That's the way, of course, in which the Greeks were filtering their ideas through the traumas of conquest, invasion, or the threat of invasion, at least, that they were dealing with. But 100 years later, after the Persian Wars have been fought, and while Persia is not out of the picture for the Greeks by no shot at all, it's still the most powerful empire in the world, the Persian threat is being neutralized somewhat with scenes like this, which are far more celebrations of the exoticism of ancient Persia. For over a century, the Greeks, and in particular the Athenians, had witnessed Persians. They knew what they looked like on the battlefield. They had captured Persian tents, Persian clothing. They had feasted in Persian ways. They had morphed their own traditions to echo Persian tropes as well. And so there's a very different feeling in 4th century Attic art about the relationship between Persia and Greece. Essentially, what we're doing here is that we're looking in a world far, far away in almost a once upon a time quality. It really does have an open sesame feel. It's very much in line with other kinds of artworks created by Attic, that is Athenian painters at this time. Famously, there's a huge vase in Naples by an individual we simply call the Darius painter, which shows a scene at the Persian court, the center and lower band of the line drawing that you can see there, which has a kind of theatrical flavor about it, almost as though the Persians are in fancy dress. And likewise, this little lekythos, which is gilded and with raised figures, which is by a man called the Xenophanes painter, and now in St. Petersburg, which was found in the Crimea, shows a kind of fantastical version of the Persian royal hunt. Persians who are named, incidentally, Abocrames, Darius, Cyrus, and so forth, are shown in this kind of mythological setting where they fight, where they hunt for boars, but also they hunting mythological animals, perhaps on the far section of the vase. You can see on the left of the screen, you can see there is a winged griffin, for instance. One of my favorites is this huge crater now in the Kunsthistorisches Museum in Vienna. which shows a kind of fantastical scene of a great king seated within his court. There he is on his throne within a kind of naos, a little sort of almost like a little shrine. A woman stands before him, fanning him. And on either side of him, you can see there are dancing figures and also musicians, very much echoing the themes of the camel lekythos that we began with. And this is very much the kind of feeling that we're having in the fourth century artistic response in Greece to the world of ancient Persia. So what I want to do is to zoom in to one or two details of this vase to try to put it into its context. How do the Greeks get to this understanding of a Persian world, this rather fantastical Persian world? And let's start with the camel. Now, as far as depictions of camels go, it's not so very bad, I suppose, but one gets the feeling that the artist who created this red figure vase is painting a camel from a description rather than from seeing it in real life, I would imagine. That's not to say that the Greeks didn't know about camels. And in fact, the earliest camel representation I've ever found in the Greek world dates to about 550 BCE. So this is really at the time that Cyrus is starting his campaigns in Lydia, for instance. And it's a Bactrian camel as well, a two-humped camel of all things. And this vase was found in Boeotia, which of course was under Persian occupation for quite a while in the fifth century. But it's a pretty good camel. I mean, that's quite an accurate camel. Less accurate, less successful, but rather charming is this Pelike by the Argos painter, dated to the period of the Persian Wars themselves. And this shows a camel driver with another Bactrian camel with a rather elongated back and a serpentine kind of neck. How did the Greek artists get these images in the first place? Well, of course, either they saw camels or they heard reports of camels, or they were able to access bona fide Persian images of camels created by Persian artists, possibly in Asia Minor, such as this bulai, this seal stone, because of course these kind of images, bulai, seals, especially when pressed into wet clay, could travel very, very widely indeed. So even an unsuccessful artist like this had an inkling of what a camel looked like, perhaps from a genuine bona fide Persian version. And at Persepolis alone, there are four very, very fine representations of Bactrian camels who are gifted to the great king by various delegations, mostly from Iranian speaking peoples, including Bactrians themselves. And you'll see from the detail that I've given you there, the level of representation is of very high indeed. And this has to figure as a really, really fine animal portrait. The haughtiness of that camel is something which is very memorable. Camels, of course, were core to ancient Persian life, alongside the horse, which played an equally important role in Achaemenid society. From the Elamite cuneiform text, which we know as the Persepolis fortification text, for instance, we have many accounts of a herd of camels that belonged to King Darius the Great. There's consistently 33 of them, and these tend to be, they tend to follow the great king whenever he moves locales. So when he goes from Persepolis to Susa or from Susa to Babylon, his own herd of camels go along with him. So the king is a herdsman as much as anything. And of course, within royalty today, this is the King of Jordan, of course, the expression of power and prestige, of luxury indeed, is still articulated through the use of the camel. Camels, of course, in traditional camel societies are used not only as pack animals, but more importantly, in a way, as animals for sport, camel racing, camel wrestling, and of course, amongst the army. And we know for certain that the Persians had a camel corps in the Achaemenid army known as the Ushabara, Ushra being the ancient Persian word for the camel. And from a series of seals that we have from the Achaemenid period, we see the great king both in a camel-pulled chariot, as well as hunting lions in the wild from camelback. And Strabo, at the end of the first century BC, also recalls that place, a village called Gaugamela, where, of course, a famous battle was fought with Alexander, Darius III lost his empire. But the name of the village, Gaugamela, means camel's house, and it was given its name by Darius the Great because he housed his favorite camel there, or so we are told, living in particular luxury, I wouldn't be surprised. So that's the camel. And then, of course, we have the camel rider, the great king of Persia himself. You can see he has a little whip in his hand. His other arm is kind of out, stretched out. It's almost as though he's kind of trying to keep his balance as the ship of the desert sways back and forth as he's sitting strangely on this howdah, kind of side saddle, if you like. It's a sort of thing that the Greek artists really like playing with. In the exhibition, we have this beautiful little vase of a Persian soldier sitting on a donkey. And what this does, of course, is allow for foreshortening for the artist. And whenever we see foreshortening, so here the legs, the feet, and the toes of the soldier, and here of the king, this always kind of rings some sort of a warning bell in the viewer's head, because of course most Greek vase painting shows the human body side on. So when we see something like this, automatically we think, oh, there's something strange going here. And I think what's going on here is that the artist is trying to show, this is kind of weird, this is exotic, this is not us, it is very much part of the other. The king himself is depicted in a very kind of conventionally Greek way of good-looking men, with a very, very straight nose. It contradicts what Xenophon tells us about Cyrus the Great. He says in the Cyropaedia, because Cyrus the Great had a hooked nose, men in Persia all favored hooked noses and thought them themselves to be the most beautiful, those who had the most exaggerated hook. But here we have basically almost an Athenian dressed up in Persian fancy dress, if you like. And this very distinctive form of clothing had been around in the Greek imagination of the Persians ever since the first time that the Persians came into the Greek world. The Greeks were absolutely fascinated by this riding habit that the Persians wore, consisting of a long sleeve tunic, very often with a long sleeve coat worn over the shoulders, but most notable were these trousers, perfect garments, of course, for horseback riding and camel riding in the ancient Near East, but totally out of the ordinary for the Greeks. In fact, Herodotus states in his histories that it was the Athenians who were the first Greeks to endure the sight of Persian trousers, to actually endure them. So trousers as something of a trauma. But it's this kind of clothing which remains over the centuries in the Greek imagination for the Persians themselves. By the time the camel Lekythos is painted, the Greeks are really obsessed with this idea of the king and the luxury of his court. And several scenes which are extant take the viewer into the harem of the great king. You see he on the vase at the center there from Cyprus, we have a great king seated on a throne, holding his scepter and drinking from a vitron with a woman in front. And then the larger pellicae from the Louvre shows the king with two of his women. Now, these women, of course, are not depicted in Persian dress at all. And that's because basically the Greeks have no concept of what Persian royal women wore. And so they simply depict them as Athenian upper class women. But what is interesting here is this fourth century notion that we can penetrate behind the walls of the royal harem to look at the private life of the king. And in a way, this is what's being picked up on the camel Lekythos as well, with the presence here of the king's entertainers. We've already recognized them on the vase from Vienna on the left of the screen. You can see dancing boys and dancing girls doing exactly this kind of dance, which according to the Greek sources was called the persika, which was a Persian war dance or a ritual dance of masculine triumph, essentially. Whether this really is it, of course, is open to debate, but certainly the sources, the Greek sources, talk about this style of dance. And then we have a series of musicians dressed in Persian clothing, but actually playing very Greek-looking instruments, timpanis, kithara, and double aulos, and so forth. And on the other side of the vase, we see that continuing again, more of these musicians, more of the dancers, male and female interspersed. Of particular interest, I think, are the barefaced individuals, shaved features of these men. They're certainly in male costume. You can see that they contrast quite clearly to the female on the left side of the vase there. They are in male costume, but they are beardless. And that's in striking contrast to the other men on the vase, the king himself and the people dancing the war dance. And these are probably Greek representations of Persian eunuchs. Now, the Greek historians spoke a lot about eunuchs. They were obsessed with this idea of the male castrati from the East. They found it abhorrent, but absolutely fascinating at the same time. But it is quite clear that by the fourth century, very wealthy Athenians were using castrated men as slaves within their households, usually as prestigious things like doorkeepers and stewards. And in fact, this very, very rare fragmentary red figure vase here from Athens shows a castrated male slave. So its eunuchs are pretty much part of that Greek conception of as living beings, as luxury objects being utilized within Greece. We can look in the exhibition, for instance, these are both there for the use of peacocks is a similar motif. Peacocks coming from Persia and being used by wealthy Athenians. When you put this whole vase together, it's clearly a scene of some sort of celebratory procession. Benjamin Isaac, in a paper he submitted to a volume on racism in antiquity, described this scene as a hotbed of orgiastic dissipation. Now, maybe my idea of orgiastic is different to his, but I simply do not see it here. What I do see is a kind of festal feeling, certainly. And Alan Shapiro thought that maybe what we have going on here is a theme playing on the idea of foreign gods being encountered in Athens for the first time. And we do know that in the fourth century BC, Near Eastern gods were certainly being part, were part of the religious landscape of Athens at this period. But I don't think that's really what is going on here either. I think what's being kind of played with here is a very well-known Persian happening, and that is the way in which the king of Persia migrated around his empire from location to location, essentially enjoying the warmth of a perpetual springtime, as Xenophon puts it. It's part of the peripatetic lifestyle of the court. Here we have a chart basically telling us where different classical authors place the royal court at different times of the year. But essentially what we get from the classical sources is an annual migration between Persepolis, Babylonia, and Ecbatana, modern Hamadan, in the north, constantly every year in this endless migration. And the Greeks were very well aware of this, and they were quite obsessed with it. It's part of a rich court culture that the Greeks really fixated on. And incidentally, it's exactly the kind of court travel, the peripatetic lifestyle of royal courts that we see in Persianate societies of later dates, in particular, of course, amongst the Mughals of India, northern India. So to finish with here, what I think is going on in this vase then, it's not a kind of a degradation, a playing down, or even a kind of riff or a kind of comedy on the Persians. I think it is a kind of a somewhat orientalist idea of the king, the luxury and power of his majesty himself, but it's not done in any disparaging way at all. But it has got a dose of orientalism, without a doubt, but I think actually it's a very benign orientalism. It is not a weakening thing. The great king here is master of his court, master of his lands, and is celebrated as such for his wealth and his ability to control a huge cortege of individuals like this. So rather than being a negative form of orientalism, I think this is a very positive spin on the great king and his court. Fantastic. Well, everybody, I want to thank you on behalf of the British Institute of Persian Studies for joining us this evening for this webinar. And in particular, I want to thank Dr. James Fraser for his wonderful paper and answering such questions so well. Just remains to say thank you very much again for attending this, and we hope to see you at the next BIPS webinar. Thank you very much.